I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the program we call Wide World. I'm a talk show host in the States. Thrilled to be in Ghana and to be broadcasting on Choice 102.3 FM. We're talking about the internet and what it can do for Ghana. Electronic.
That's www.eff.org.
For electronic freedom.
Frontier. I understand this.
Foundation. I'm sorry, John. I've made that mistake before, and I'll probably make it again.
Lots him.
But John thinks about the web all the time. And
I think about human discourse all the time.
Well, that's another way of saying it. But he's one of the visionary thinkers and talkers about this medium.
No, it's an environment. I guess I'm just going to keep doing this.
I'm going to get out of your way, John.
This is quite fun.
I'm just going to get out of your way.
No. It's sort of fun having you in my way.
What can the internet do for Africa?
At best, the internet can help Africa skip the industrial period.
Thank you very much.
Which, and this now seems to be a relatively commonly held belief. There was a time when I think I was one of very few people who believed it.
What does that mean? Skipping the pollution,
skipping the dehumanization. I mean, the industrial period is about turning human beings into interchangeable machine parts. And one of the reasons that Africa was left out of the industrial period is because they have a different sense of time here. And the organizing principle of industry is time. Everything has to fit into this neatly lockstep pattern where life is ruled by showing up and being there and doing this at this time and doing that at that time. This is not conducive to African patterns of life. And so Africa sort of shrugged that whole period of history off and is suffering somewhat economically, but has not had to suffer, I think, the worst depravities that have been inflicted on us. I mean, you come to Africa and you see still a sense of human connection that is almost entirely missing from the Northern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. When I first, I'll back up a little bit. I was writing about the possibility of new economies developing in parts of the world that didn't seem to have much of any economy at all. Based on my own experience. I'd been a cattle rancher for the larger part of my early life. And, you know, as such in the tail end of the agricultural period. And I knew that I was functionally unemployable in an industrial economy. So when I decided that I couldn't go on being a cattle rancher since most of the people who were doing it didn't have to earn a living at it, I started casting about for other things that I might do, and I was intrigued by the internet. This is clear back in 86, for reasons that we can go into if we have time. But I felt like I could recreate some of the sort of habits of mind that I had as an agricultural person in this new economic environment, and I would never have to be dehumanized in the way that industrialization dehumanizes one. And since I was also functionally unemployable, this was kind of a necessity.
From the farm to the electronic frontier in one jump.
Yeah, leapfrog as they now commonly say when they talk about these things. So I was writing pieces about digital economy for Wired, and I was talking a lot about the potential of the poor world, which is mostly southern. And the editor of Wired at one point said, Poirot, you seem to know an awful lot about Africa for somebody who's never been there, which was devastatingly true. And I said, yeah, that's accurate, but I'll bet you could fix that. And I, you know, I must admit, when he said, yeah, I'll send you off to Africa, I had the usual sense of missionary zeal that the North almost always does when it heads this direction. I mean, I wanted to come to Africa to help Africa. I mean, this is really, this is narcissistic and grandiose, but I wanted to help Africa do what I had done, which was to leapfrog the industrial period. And the idea that, you know, simply because you've done it, an entire continent could do it is probably pathological. But I came down here thinking that I could help give Africa what we had, you know, money by coming down here, understanding the situation, figuring out how to help wire it up and connect it, then they could do as I had done, and they could become part of this new economy, and they could get the money, and the money would flow downstream from the North, and everything would be groovy. I got here and I realized that if anybody was poor, it wasn't Africa, it was us. And my desire was suddenly not to wire Africa so that the money could flow downstream, but so that heartfulness and connection might flow upstream, or at least that there would be a perfectly symmetrical flow. It wouldn't be the usual, you know, the usual deal where, you know, some northern institution comes down here and with its excellent intentions turns Africa into an addict. And that's been one of my big purposes in life ever since.
John, that's a great story, and I've never heard it before. Do you remember sort of a moment when your head flipped on which way the stream was going?
Oh, it was actually as I was, I wasn't even out of the United States. I was headed to Africa. And I was my landfall in Africa was Accra. And on my first attempt, I was flying Air Ghana, and is it
Ghana Airways?
Ghana Airways, that's right. I was flying Ghana Airways from New York, and I made the mistake of showing up 55 minutes before flight time. And there is nothing like somebody from the poor world to stick it to somebody from the rich world over time. You know, you're late, said the African.
Yes.
to the white guy.
The white man.
You know. So I said, well, you know, I'll just catch the next flight. Well, there isn't one till Tuesday, which was 3 days later. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll change my ticket to another airline. They're not interchangeable.
Yeah.
So immediately I sort of slammed up against something that was kind of new to me. So I come back on Tuesday, and I'm being a little more careful this time. But as I was headed to the airport, a helicopter crashed into the entrance of the Midtown Tunnel, which I was passing mm-hmm. through, which brought me in 45 minutes before flight time. I see the same guy. And I start to rail at him and explain, and he's looking at me with this utterly impassive gaze like, it's really not his problem. And then something clicked in me. I mean, this was kind of like the first click, which was that being angry at this guy was going to get me nowhere. And, you know, in my northern way, I thought, well, then nothing's going to get me anywhere, because all I know how to do is threaten and shout. And I put my head down on the counter, and I was abject. And I was really at the point of tears, and this guy comes around the counter and puts his arm around me and said, "We will make it happen." Well, by the time that was taking place, it was already really way too late, period. And I said, "You can't make it happen now." And he said, "Oh yes, I can." And I said, "How?" And he said, "Well, of course the bus is left for the plane, which was parked, you know, about 5 miles away." And I said, "Well, how can you make that happen?" And he said, "There's one of the cargo pods that is still going out, and we'll put you in the cargo pod. You know, those things that they load into the plane. And you go out to the plane in that, and then they'll take you out of the cargo pod and you can go into the plane." And I said, "Well, what?"
You'd be in deep trouble for doing that today, of course.
That's not Bin Laden.
Well, the whole thing, you know. What I'm getting at, Chris, is that I felt like I'd entered into a new reality right then and there. I mean, climbing into that cargo pod is when I entered Africa. You know, and having the faith to think that they would absolutely open that thing up when I got to the other end, and that I wouldn't get a chance to experience a transatlantic flight in cargo at 40 below.
Exactly.
And they did. I'm glad you kind of opened this box of the sort of the social psychology of this medium. It stuck in my mind a couple of years ago, somebody saying that the 21st century and computers would be friendly to the American way because computers so resemble certain ways that Americans work competitively in terms of our lack of tradition. We love instant obsolescence. We love fast turnover. We love decentralized institutions. There's something very happily individual about the American psychology.
This is also what we make of computers.
Well, it may be nonsense too.
Well, I mean, you know, what we make of computers is you sitting alone in your room with your screen. What they make of computers is like the village well.
It is.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it.
I mean, it's a completely different.
What is the connection between sort of PC computer world and the web and the internet and the sort of sociology and psychology of Africa? And I'd love Herman's view on this.
And he was coming to me.
Well, I was hoping he was going to get that Dolly World. You know a hell of a lot about Africa,
yeah,
for
exactly,
somebody who doesn't spend much time here.
I think that's essentially, as an African, my opinion at least, is that the internet basically, as I said before, connects us to the world. And it's
and each other.
And each other, yes. And it's real. I'll tell you some of the little things that the internet does for us. We have a contract in northern Nigeria, and we develop software. Now, you have a situation where one of our guys is working out in Bauchi, which is a town in northern Nigeria. He finds there's a bug in the software.
Probably, literally.
Yeah, exactly. Now, before the internet, what would this mean? He would find a plane, take him 2-3 days to Lagos, or a bus or whatever, and then get on a plane and come to Ghana, have the software fixed, he'll turn around, go back to Lagos, find a bus to somewhere else, and get to Bauchi. Total time elapsed, a week to 2 weeks. Same thing today, thanks to the internet. SMS message to one of our phones in Accra says, "Get behind the machine, 30 minutes, I'll be online." While he jumps in the taxi and goes to an internet cafe in Bauchi, he sits behind the machine, MSN Messenger, thank God for that. "Hi, are you online?" "Yes, we're here." "There is a bug on the so-and-so-and-so option. Could you test it now and verify?" "Testing. Verified, we found it. Could you fix it now?" "Yes." "Stand by." "Compiling." "Testing." "Sent." "The file size is wrong." "That's the first half. Have you seen the next half now? The second half now?" "Good. Test on your side." "Got it." Thank you very much. Bye-bye. 15 minutes. This is the difference.
Which is real interaction.
Yeah.
I mean, at a distance.
Yeah.
I think...
Mark Davis.
Communication. I traveled up through the Sudan in 1981 when I was 18. I didn't speak a word of Arabic. I was, you know, for 2 months essentially surrounded by people that I could not communicate with. Or at least that's what I thought when I started. But I spent all of that time communicating every minute of every day. And there is an art to communication sure. in this part of the world that does not exist in
right.
the North,
that's right.
where the crudity of communication, the inability to understand the different ways in which you can communicate. Mm-hmm. Any Northerner that has come down and been dropped into a place where they cannot speak the language, learn this art. Now, I don't know if this is just an African
thing.
Or
learn this heart.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you have provided great communicators with another tool to communicate.
Yeah.
And that's part of what the story is here.
But I think we should not underestimate also, I heard you speak a lot on the internet and communication and connection and what Africa can teach the world. Now, as an African, I'll tell you this, poverty is also real.
Now, oh, I got that.
Uh-huh, and there's no dignity in poverty. I mean, there's nobody can tell me they're having a good time. They have a big headache and no money to buy a painkiller.
All I know is that I've been in some really desperately poor areas, and they're a lot readier with a smile than they are in most of the suburbs of America.
No doubt. But I agree with you completely. But I think that...
And I'm not saying that's consolation enough.
Exactly. I think that the internet should provide an environment where... I'll tell you what I imagine the future of the internet is. Some small village community have a bunch of mango trees,
mm-hmm.
and they plant a particular kind of special mango, which only grows in this part of that village, let's say. And they have some customers in Japan. And now the whole village makes $1,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Mark putting up some internet cafe 10 miles away, a big center where all the villagers go to, they now have some group in Japan who love these mangoes because they use them to eat with sushi or something. And so they buy $10,000 of mangoes every month.
Mm-hmm.
So that now the kids are going to school thanks to the internet, one, and then now they can employ some, you know, 2x4 teacher who will be helping the kids with their math.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's happy, and the big chief is there. And, you know, this is the kind of thing I see the internet doing. Because mm-hmm. that's the one thing we're missing. Just the basics in terms of cash to get little things done, so that a lot of talent is going to waste. And to harness talent, it needs to be directed.
Well, I was listening to you guys on the way over here, and Chris was being, I think, even self-consciously New Englandy and liberal.
I see there's a big battle going on.
Yeah, I like that. I'm actually kind of a fan of electronic sweatshops, especially if they're in villages. I mean, one of my goals for the immediate future in Africa is to use the internet to make it possible for the people to remain in their village.
Yeah,
which is, you know, for an African, I mean, and Africa is lots of different places, and they're really quite different, but there are some cross-cutting things, and one of them is best described by a Zulu expression, which I think is Ubuntu, or Ubuntu,
mm-hmm.
which loosely means I am because you are.
Hmm.
And they have, in the fabric of rural Africa, where 70% of the people still live, they maintain that sense of larger identity, larger self, and they're facing a lot of the same fallout of the Green Revolution that the rest of us do. I mean, the Green Revolution sounds like a great thing since more people get fed. But on the other hand, it takes far fewer people to feed them.
Exactly.
And, you know, and as a consequence, there's a lot of surplus labor out there in the hills who head into these unbelievably horrible conditions.
Exactly.
and lose I am that you are, or lose that I am at all.
Exactly.
And so I think that the possibility of the internet to create workplaces in those villages, and there's a lot of stuff to do. I mean, you know, we have the incredible task before us of trying to take all of previously generated human knowledge and digitize it. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of work.
It is.
And, you know, a lot of the Northern Hemisphere is going to find that, whether it ought to be or not, beneath their dignity. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if it means that they get paid,
it's a romantic but a very beautiful vision. You're really talking about repealing 250 years of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, no, I'm not talking about repealing it, because it was a necessary phase of human existence. But I don't, you know, in order to get us where we are now. But I don't want anybody else to have to suffer that stuff.
So we're going to miss. But we're going to say goodbye to Dickens and Marx and Freud and all those headaches and all that capitalism and all that heavy.
Interesting. Let's give it a shot.
I'm with you.
Mm. Does this
sound reasonable to you, Herman?
Well, yes and no. I think that there are certain aspects of industrialization that we cannot avoid. I'll give you an example. See that village I described where they have these special mangoes that they export to Japan and make $10,000? Mm-hmm. There will still be problems of distributing that wealth. Small as it may seem, there will still be the need to move the mangoes to an airport.
Oh, yeah.
And put it in a freight container and ship it out. Yep. There will still be the need for the agency that handles the freight forwarding, etc., etc.
You got to have infrastructure and that's...
But on your sweatshop idea, I think it's great. You know why? You see, firstly, look at Africa as an entity. What are we doing now? We're tearing things out of the ground and exporting them.
What's worse is that you're borrowing more and more money from those northern institutions that are hopelessly enslaving.
Exactly. At ridiculous rates. Mm. And we're tearing things out of the ground. Things that would be even more valuable in the future.
Absolutely.
And shipping them off.
Right.
So the guys in the village are sitting there. Some big company comes up and tears the timber out.
Yeah.
If the big company comes and says, instead of tearing the timber out, that, hey, I'm going to put 6,000 machines here, man. Now, if you feel like typing one morning, why don't you just come over and earn $2?
Right.
I think it beats...
And you don't have to do it on Western time.
No, you don't.
Or Northern time. You don't have to show up at 9 o'clock in the morning and leave at 5. You can come in and tap whenever you want.
Yeah, we'll do it Ghana Away style. We'll book.
But I don't think that the internet is there just for sweatshops or necessarily...
Oh, I'm just talking about
once you
get that going, then you fatten up the pipe.
Sure.
Exactly.
Absolutely. But I think as a whole... It is partly industrialized here already. There are businesses that are operating, and I think there are opportunities.
Well, no, wait a second. There's a big difference between business and industry.
Right. Mm. There are industries and there are businesses, but I think there are industries that are existing here. Small-scale industries.
They're not making cars in Ghana.
They're not, but they are processing things. They are purchasing things, and I think that to a certain extent, using the internet to assist them. Be more competitive with their competitors overseas,
sure.
Or processing the mangoes in the village, not just sort of growing them and shipping them.
There are also things that can happen in Africa that would be difficult to make them happen elsewhere. I mean, one of the tasks before humanity at the moment is dealing with human discourse between different languages. And machines are never really going to be that great at it. I mean, you can get them up to like 98%, but you know, that missing 2% is the source of an enormous amount of misunderstanding. Mm. So the best thing to do, if you really want to have a good conversation with somebody who doesn't speak your language at all, is to have a human being in the middle, a translator. Mm. Well, there are 12-year-old kids all over, you know, and teaching them, you know, to go in there and say, well, all right, we're going to teach you Ukrainian and Serbo-Croat. Mm. Mm. That's not a big deal to them.
No. I want to introduce the callers. And the phone is 70.
No, it's not 11. An elder meeting. It's real. You know,
it's proper work. It's high value.
100. Yeah. Let me just read the phone. 70, 11, 200 or 70, 11, 100. We call this program Wide World. We're talking about the internet in Ghana. John Perry, well, we've talked about it as the great equalizer at many levels, but John Perry Barlow says it's the great equalizer between deindustrialized or unindustrialized Africa and the crumbling old rust belt in the rest of the world. Give them a call at 70 11 100 or 70 11 200. Caller, welcome. Hello.
Yeah, hello, good evening.
Good evening to you.
Yeah, thank you for your program. I think we could not take the Industrial Revolution. That is why we Africans are where we are. And I think we must take the advent of the information communication technology revolution so that that could make us move forward. And the government have to remove all barriers, you know, taxes that they impose on computer importation so that enable computer technology become faster and then that will evolve this nation. But I have a question for your panel. So what is the future of the World Wide Web? And that is one. Two, will the World Wide Web increase traffic, which will cause a catastrophe, or will the web continue to evolve as a primary communication channel? That is three. People are making money on the World Wide Web. So will the web become self-supporting? That is what I want to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who wants to answer the question about the future of the web itself?
I'm not qualified to.
John?
Well, I didn't hear the question.
Well, the question was the future of the web, and will it be overcrowded or overwhelmed? I think he wanted to know.
Well, I mean, there's infinite space in cyberspace. Overwhelmed in what sense?
Well, I'm not sure. Is there space on the web for...
Well, I mean, there's functionally no limit.
Exactly.
Okay. The caller also raised a question indirectly about the government. John, you're famous in the internet circles for insisting that the government, all governments, get out of the way and stay out of the way. In terms of education, subsidy, incentives, deregulation that Herman was talking about earlier, do you have any advice for the governments?
Stay the hell out of the way. Well, I mean, the first order of business, I think, in Africa, and fortunately Ghana is a little bit ahead of the curve here, though not as far as I thought they would be when I first came here. You know, I thought that by now things would be further along than they are because they had a pretty good start. The principal problem with the so-called digital divide is not affording hardware. It's getting around government regulation that is designed to maintain a certain franchise for mm-hmm. for the incumbent, mm-hmm. and also assure this really kind of enslaving and stupid system where in some cases 25% of the hard currency that comes into a country is the result of phone bills charged by the PTT, mm-hmm. Not on the locals but on the neocolonials and the NGOs. You know, it's having exorbitant phone bills for just basic service, since it's assumed that the regular folks don't want phones anyway, makes it, I mean, and you know, they may or may not.
It narrows the use.
Hello.
Well, in any case, what it does is it means that, you know, they don't think about lowering their phone rates,
right,
because there's this huge amount of money that comes in from these northern organizations paying their phone bills. Mm-hmm. I mean, and also, you know, frankly, there are people on the take that have a huge vested interest in, you know, seeing that money comes in. And so when you say let's deregulate and let's lower costs and let's do this and do that, they kind of freak out.
Okay. We're talking about the internet, what it can do for Ghana, what Ghana can do for it. The phone is 70-11-100 or 70-11-200. Caller, welcome to Wide World.
Yeah. My name is Eric.
Eric, good evening.
Yeah, I just want to make some one or two contributions to this program.
Please.
First of all, what I would like to say is that we Africans missed the Industrial Revolution. So we shouldn't allow the IT revolution to also, we shouldn't miss that one too. And one area I think we have a very big advantage is the human resource, which we have to develop. But even though it's not very easy, but you see there are areas like this, tele-teaching, telemedicine, a whole lot of things that when we are able to use them, we improve a whole lot of things. For example, Ghana. Taking for example, everybody is aware that the northern region is a bit deprived in terms of some things. When we have a hospital in the northern region hooked up to a Kolobo Teaching Hospital, for example, a specialist at a Kolobo Teaching Hospital can lend a hand to do some operations and other things in the northern region. The same way maybe some deprived schools in the northern region or other places or other far places or in the Afran Plains, for example, can benefit from the teaching of some lessons from some special lecturers and other things. So we have a whole lot of things to do and to take advantage of. So when this internet or this worldwide world can help Ghana a whole lot and other Africa countries if you're able to develop this technology. So one area I would like to re-emphasize again is talking about human resource development. India has done it, and the world knows that they are IT giants now in terms of software development. So that's my contribution.
Eric, thank you. Herman, did you want to respond to Eric?
Yeah, I agree with him completely. What I'd like to say to that is that I'd like to talk about geographical independence in the context of what he's saying. Now, there are lots of Ghanaians abroad who are abroad because they need money. And salaries, like the doctors and so on he spoke about, salaries are not the way they should be here, given that we're a developing country. So they have to work abroad. I've met very few Ghanaians who actually enjoy living abroad. They want to live in Ghana. Mm-hmm. Circumstances are such that they can't. And I know a lot of white people who want to live in Ghana too.
Mm.
But they want to be able to earn a decent living and have a good standard of living. Now, one of the things the internet is going to do is that the traditional mechanism whereby people graduate from school here and automatically turn around as long as their skills are saleable and go to the West.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as they could sit in Ghana and work and earn a decent wage, they won't go. They'll rather than go to the West, they'll go to their village and hook up online and provide their services online. This can happen with psychologists, doctors, anybody you can think of, unless there's a physical contact required. Now, on the other hand also, if, for example, Ghana government set up towns which had internet connectivity, we might end up having a bunch of NASA scientists working out of Accra, because they log on every morning and they work 8 hours and then they go and swim in the African River around the back and go and check out some animals.
Why would it take the government when you guys could do just as good a job? I mean, just the two of you.
I'll tell you what the game is. Raising money is very, very difficult. In the context of our software development, we pride ourselves on developing tropically tolerant software. One of the that's what we call it, tropical tolerance, a new buzzword.
Tropicalized.
Yeah.
Now,
one of the problems we have here is access to capital. If you walk into a bank here, you could talk till the cows come home about this idea you've got and so on and so forth. They'll ask you, have you got a house as collateral?
Yeah, but you know, this is one of these things, this is one of these dreadful things that we've taught you.
Well, no, I disagree. I disagree. I think in America...
What do you mean, John?
Well, I mean that you have to go to the bank. There's another model, like the Grameen Bank. Are you familiar with that? Micro loans?
Yes, I do.
It's a relatively self-generative process.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not that showing up on your knees looking for a loan.
But it will not give Mark and I $20 million
20 million.
To go out and build a nice village, and call it NASA Village, and get the NASA engineers to move out here and work out of here, and teach our children in their free time.
What about, I mean, look, I had sort of a revelatory experience at one point in Uganda. I went to a high school in Uganda. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I went there is that I'd seen their website, which was all text, mm-hmm. but it was really interesting, and it was all stories. Mm-hmm. And I thought that having a website that consisted entirely of stories and text was kind of interesting, no graphics at all. I get there and I find out that the website is running on an IBM XT clone with a floppy disk drive using software that these kids have written themselves.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. You know, the whole thing costing, you know, $3 and change. Mm-hmm. And an enormous amount of creativity. And I think that when I said this is something you've learned from us, the idea that it has to be done in this way is
with the house's collateral.
I think the problem that Herman's company faces is that companies locally expect his company to appear in a certain way.
Northern.
They are taking examples from the north and saying, the northerners are the ones that we want.
Right.
Exactly. So if he's to compete with them, he must.
Mean, you're in a really cool position because you have respect and success, which means that you can start doing things in an African way. I mean, instead of.
Yes and no.
I want to let a caller into the conversation.
I'm sorry, but I mean,
you sound like a preacher.
No, man.
Stand by. The phone is 70-11-100 or 70-11-200. We call this program Wide World. Caller, you're on the line. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm Kwesi.
Kwesi.
Yeah.
Welcome, Kwesi.
My point is, for one to work effectively on the net, the person is supposed to have enough time, sit on the net, go around, look at things, get ideas, say that he could come up with certain things. But looking at the way the bills are, it's very expensive for one to sit on the net for that long period of time. If you are not careful, whatever you are going to get cannot even commensurate to what bills that you are going to pay. So in the long run, it's not encouraging. It's not going to encourage people to go along that line. And one thing that also bothers me is the fact that in the developed world, local calls and most of these things are free. But the same companies who come here, come and organize the same telecommunication network here, and the prices are far more expensive to the third world, considering the fact that the third world are even poorer than the developed world. Mm. But the developed world, the local costs are mostly free. So I tend to wonder, what is happening?
Well,
I don't know whether you can give me answers to that.
Yeah, this sounds like history.
This sounds like an old familiar tale. I mean, you know, we come down here and work you over. You know, we've been doing this for a while.
Because the reason why I'm saying this is the fact that you are talking about people staying in the villages, working and that kind of thing, and how are they going to pay their bills? Whilst we are now the bills that we are paying, do you think that somebody in the village can pay that one? It's not possible. So it means right from the start, we are restricting the thing to the affluent.
No, I disagree with you. I think that if we have a sharp minister of telecommunications,
uh-huh.
he can strike complicated deals with four companies.
And you are saying he can strike complicated deals.
Yes.
How long is it going to take him to strike that deal? That is also the problem.
6 months is not an issue, but that they haven't done it is fascinating. But
how many conferences that will go through the pipeline before that thing comes into existence?
I agree, but I think
it's really hoping.
It's not even a money issue in this case, because we have the whole country to promise. I mean, when South Africa did the telecoms thing, when they deregulated their telecoms, they gave it to one or two companies and told them to promise that they'll have a telephone in every village by a certain year.
Yeah, that's it.
And for that reason, they will give them 5 years free reign on everybody else.
Yeah, that's it.
All these deals are available to our people.
But Ghana, some people promise.
And also in South Africa,
Ghana people promise that to get us some lines, and they failed. So at times it's a bit of a problem.
The system is rolling. Are we out of courtrooms?
Well, you've had somebody,
somebody needs to go to jail.
Okay. I think the law should bite and bite well.
Exactly.
It needs
to go to jail. Very simple.
Thank the law.
To go to jail. Nothing.
Well,
like
also,
that.
I mean, I think that you know, really, you and this is not a simple problem to solve. You have a whole matrix of disabling assumptions that are perpetuated largely for the advantage of the North by the North, but also by simple habit. And it's difficult to break out of habits, even though they may be really bad.
I mean, like exploiting other people.
Well, not just it's even more complicated than that. It's, I mean, you know, in South Africa, SBC comes in, buys part of the supposedly deregulated PTT, and immediately becomes far more aggressive and exploitative than even the local PTT was. And this happens over and over again. I mean, and because,
but John, the rule in the state surely has been that the price miraculously keeps coming down and down and down. Eventually they give away cell phones. Shouldn't that happen here too?
That's because there is, you know, not to the extent that I think is appropriate or possible, but there is deregulation of telecommunications.
Exactly. And competition.
And actual competition.
Yeah.
Nobody
can hold your license and ability to operate.
Right, and unfortunately, there's a natural tendency that was, you know, established during the colonial era to try to regulate towards scarcity in every regard, and you know, the people who were part of the moneyed class in an African country spend a lot of time regulating towards scarcity because they assume that it serves them. They don't have a sense that there's a possibility of creating a bigger pie. Mm-hmm. They just want a bigger share of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also you've got these aid organizations that have absolutely no interest in solving the problem if you think about it.
They don't.
Then they'll be out of a job.
And then they'd be out of a job. Mm-hmm. So they come in with loans, they come in with incredibly cumbersome practices and programs, and then you have northern corporations that come in and say they're going to help out and they're going to give you technology and do this and do that.
But we also have sleepy Africans who condone it.
Well, I mean, because how could they know any different? I mean, it's been a habit that's been established for at least 400 years.
Stand by for callers. Callers rule.
Hello.
On Wide World.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello.
Tell us your name.
Gilbert is my name. And good evening to you, gentlemen. Okay. Over there.
Thank you.
Yes, I have this program, and I like us to look at it. Before now, we have been introduced to the IT information technology worldwide, which is a good phenomenon. But before then. Before the introduction of the information technology, there was some kind of information flow worldwide vis-a-vis trade relationship between the third world countries and then the developed nations. And then it seems within that advent, within that period where we had this information flow between nations in terms of trade, Africa did not find her footing. Our economies didn't move the way we thought it should move, even though the developed nations had information about the products we have and the services Africa could provide. Yet we didn't see much improvement in the economies, and we suffered a lot. And as a matter of fact, we are still suffering. And I remember our former President Jerry John Rawlings one time made a statement that the problem is the unfair economic world order. and that has to be addressed. So now, with the information of the with the introduction of the IT in this present the time this or present dispensation, I would like you gentlemen to tell us how this is going to have how this is going to turn the African economies around so that we'll be able to compete fairly with the rest of the world, so that poverty could be alleviated from our midst, so that we wouldn't have to depend. And then asking them to give us aid, because as the problem is, we have the resources, we have the mineral resources, we have agricultural produce, we have the manpower, we have the tech, you can name it, and yet still we are suffering. So I want you to.
I take your question. How do we get to the next African economic order?
There's an unjust economic world order.
And there, as John Barlow was saying, there are bad habits and deeply ingrained institutions, horizontal and vertical, that keep this thing in place.
I also think that you just hit on something, Chris, when you said the African order. I said earlier that a lot of the problem that the poor world has, which is mostly around the equator, is a different sense of what work is and a different sense of what time is and a different sense of how they relate to each other than you find in the north. There is nothing particularly practical or useful about our sense of time and work unless you're trying to build industrial products, and then having that notion of time and work becomes important. Now you have the opportunity to take the natural African rhythms and define those rhythms into your concepts of work so that it fits you. I think it's really a matter of getting over the habit of us in so many different ways. And the first thing is to get over the habit of thinking that, you know, work is something that happens in a certain kind of schedule.
Farming work does.
Speaking as somebody who was a rancher for a long time, I never looked at my watch. Yeah, there was a schedule, but it was the schedule of nature. It was simply a matter of adapting oneself to what was going on around me. It wasn't something that was imposed by anything but God. You see, and I think that that's what's natural in Africa. And with information, you can do that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require coordinated efforts of large numbers of people, precise to the second.
Okay, but you're humming thoughtfully.
Yeah, here. Let's comment on this. Now, I understand what John is saying, but there are two extremes in that. Look at it from the African angle. You've got lots of drummers and lots of people who can chill out, and lots of people who don't have stress problems, and lots of people. What we haven't got lots of transportation facilities, we haven't got, you see what I mean? And so that our needs, when we define them, require maybe a move further away from our extreme, somewhere closer to the middle.
Where, or a dance.
Pardon?
A dance between yours and ours.
Okay, fine. So that what happens is that we have a higher standard of living. When I say higher standard of living, I truly, personally, don't believe that being stressed out for 40 years is a good life, which is what happens on Wall Street and popping pills every day. I don't believe that's the case. But I also do not believe that. I've seen people in villages and they die from a cut.
Yeah, I was going to say clean water is something to be said for it.
By the way, did you know that most people in the world, even today, die from dirty water and dirty food.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, this is fundamental. If we need to wake up and work 4 hours a day to solve this problem, then we need to.
But that, you know, this is one of those things that the internet can address, because it's a great way of spreading simple information.
It's not just an information.
Stand by, we have a caller on the line. Caller?
Hello.
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 Hello, welcome.
Hello, Mark. You are going to pay my bill, you know?
You're going to pay.
Yeah, I'll be on the line for 5 minutes. You're going to pay.
We'll pay.
Yeah, fine.
Okay. And what did you want to say?
Yeah, I want to make a contribution. Your anecdote on the mango sort of thing you said, it looks very simplistic. Because do you think the internet will improve the circumstances of the villages if they don't actually have access to market? The way it was said.
No, the internet is the access to market.
Yeah, but the point is, there are barriers to the market. The American market is there, we always access it. But you just cannot take Ghana cocoa or any product from the agua and get there. Even the, when the whole president of the United States said Ghana under the agua can send textiles, you know the kind of problems you are facing now. There's a new set of problems which we never anticipated. That's the yam problem. So the internet by itself is rather opening up our markets for Americans, like we did to the British. We opened up our markets to help them to industrialize, and they left us. And this is my personal opinion. Now, the president of the United States in October 2001 established the OPIC, that is the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, with about $200 million, right? Which in actual fact gives guarantees and political risk insurance for investment projects in sub-Saharan Africa. But the single largest problem we are facing in sub-Saharan Africa is our foreign debt and not access to markets. If America and the rest of the first world, that's the Northern Hemisphere, they will open up their markets, we'll be able to do a lot without the internet, because we are capable. But as it is now, the internet is being used as a kind of economic tool for us to open up our market. And once this thing is open to them, they come in again, and before we realize, we are really left behind again. So personally, I can use it, but I think the way it is being used, it is against us. And until we all come on the same platform and talk in terms of access, not access to information, but access to market, this is what we need. The information is there. Now what we really need is a guarantee that we'll be given access to enter that market. Then we know that the internet is helping Africa. Apart from that, what we are saying is mere theory than practical. Thank you.
Caller, I'm glad you stayed on the line. Herman, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. I take your point completely. And that, and I agree with you that it is not only the internet that will make things work. But I think that there's a small difference with the internet. In that individuals in these countries can access the internet directly, such that if there's a Ghanaian musician in northern Ghana and he's got a following from Iceland, he can get on the internet, make music, and send the music via the internet to the people who will then pay him. This bypasses all your international barriers and traditional things that we're worrying about.
And the record company doesn't get a dime.
They don't get a dime.
That's good.
For some of the non-traditional things, it is more applicable. But I agree with you. But I think that
also think about markets among Africans.
Exactly. In the South-South.
We never think about markets among Africans.
Hold the thought. We're going to take a short break for the news. We call this program Wide World. We're talking with Mark Davis, Herman Chinnery Hess, and John Perry Barlow. We'll be back after the news.